Hello, everyone. Welcome to Moms Talk Autism. Shannon and I have a special guest with us today, so stay tuned.
When you become a mom, you never imagine your child getting an autism diagnosis. It feels like your dreams have shattered, like a framed photograph falling off your mantle, exploding into a thousand pieces. But instead of trying to glue those pieces back together, this community of moms is here to help you build a new dream. A better one. So join in the conversation as us moms talk autism.
Talk Autism is supported by Action Behavior Centers. ABC's atmosphere is bright, joyful, and welcoming, a place where children can learn, grow, and participate in child-led, play-based ABA therapy with trained professionals. ABC believes in the importance of helping your child learn valuable life skills that can benefit the whole family. With locations in Arizona, Texas, Colorado, Illinois, Minnesota, and North Carolina, there are immediate openings. Visit actionbehavior.com/momstalkautism to learn more.
All right, we are back. I am Brittany. Welcome. Welcome. We're so glad you're here with us today. And I mentioned before, Shannon is here with me.
Hey, guys.
And our special guest is a very amazing woman that Shannon and I are both in awe of and have had the privilege of learning more about before we even met her. And now we get to talk with her and you get to listen. This is Beth James Burns. And she is coming to us from Arkansas, and we are here to talk to her about her and her son, Evan, and her family and the amazing opportunity they had to be in a documentary. We'll talk about the documentary some more in a minute, but Beth, we'd just love for you to introduce yourself, talk a little bit about Evan and your family.
Wow, thanks. Well, my Evan is 33, and he was diagnosed with autism at about 3. In addition, he also does have seizure disorder and Crohn's disease. So we have the whole gamut of the neurological as well as physical aspects of autism. And we've been down lots of roads.
Yeah, you got a little bit of everything in there, don't you?
Yeah. And currently we live in Arkansas, a little town in Arkansas, very southern Arkansas. We almost live in Louisiana. It's about 20,000 people, and we love it. It has become our village for sure. I graduated from high school here and married Evan's father, who was from here after we both got back from college. And I don't know how that happened, that we ended up back in El Dorado after college, but we did. And we married then, and we had Evan. And in 2006, he died from leukemia. And so that left Evan and I on our own, which is another kind of story. And some years later, I did remarry a man who was also grew up in El Dorado, crazy, but was in St. Louis. But our sisters were mutual friends, and we had known each other. And he had 5 children. And so we blended our autism story with a story of raising 5 other kids. And so there's a sibling merge blended family in amongst all of this. But Paul, and that's my husband, and Evan and I still live in this small little Arkansas town.
I love that. And I love that, Evan, I know a lot of our listeners maybe are starting out on the journey of autism or maybe have young kids. I think we have a wide variety of listeners, but I think a majority of them are. And I think a lot of people really crave and want to know what it is like to hear from parents or caregivers with these adult autistic, you know, people in their lives. It's something that isn't really talked about a whole lot. And I know you talk about it in the documentary a little bit, but being diagnosed back in, you know, the 90s is a lot different than being diagnosed today. And it was quite the journey. And you talk a lot about it in the documentary, but I wanted to know if maybe you could give us a little background on that and what that was like, that diagnosis process.
I I so admire young people today. I really do. I admire all of you. In fact, when I read about things and I listen to podcasts, and I'm just crazy about all of y'all. I will say sometimes I do have a little autism envy going on because the 90s, were very, very different. And as kind of say in the documentary, you know, we go, we know we have a problem. We finally get to the only source in Arkansas that diagnoses neurological disorders. And that was Arkansas Children's Hospital, which is about 2 hours from us. And after we wait and wait and wait and wait, and they kind of, you know, we do the evaluations and they sit us down and they go, your kid has this thing called. And it certainly wasn't something that the average person knew anything about. Not too many people had even heard of it in the 1990s. And kind of the answer was, have a good life. Mm-hmm. And there weren't any resources. And when I say those things too, that's not a derogatory comment about healthcare providers or speech pathologists or any of those people, because we've had the best and they did their best, but there were no resources. There was no Google. There were not too many books written about it. I mean, I'm in the library with an old-fashioned card catalog trying to find periodicals. Yeah, exactly. periodicals that mention this disorder or treatments or, you know, what I'm supposed to do. I was a school teacher, taught high school. IEPs were, mm-hmm. that was not an unknown term to me. I had taught many kids in my classroom with a variety of intellectual and educational needs. So those things were not foreign to me, but this particular disorder and how I was supposed to give my kid a life, no one knew. You know, it was kind of, he's going to have not be able to do this and not be able to do that and not be able to do this. And they handed me a stack of papers about an inch high of all the periodicals they had and articles and said, see ya. And that was kind of the end of the story. And so you take your kid home and you go, wow, now what? Because I knew intrinsically I could give him a life. I just didn't know how. And I didn't find myself immediately surrounded by anyone who could tell me how to do that. In fact, I went back to the pediatrician who had kept telling me there was nothing wrong with him. And I kept saying, you know, well, like, he doesn't respond. He's not deaf. We'd already done the tubes and the hearing issues and the vision issues, you know, all those things that you would just immediately do for a child who was not appropriately responding or giving you back feedback. We'd already done that. And so when I went back, I said, they say it's this. And he was just kind of like, well, any kind of time you have a neurological disorder, the good will take over the bad and help. And I'm like, okay, he knows nothing about what I'm about to do. So that wouldn't help, you know? And so it was step by step. Then of course, picking up rocks and looking underneath them and uncovering things. But that was pretty much the situation in 1993.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. And I'm sure when you looking back on those periodicals and those, you know, the information that you did have that you researched and found, a lot of it, like you mentioned, was probably focusing on what he can't do or the negative side of things. Mm-hmm. And now I feel like, I mean, there still is places where that's there currently, but I think people tend to focus more on what they can do and what we can do to accommodate or meet this person where they are. Whereas mm-hmm. I think back then it was a lot more of almost treated like a disease or something that you could cure. You know, it's a mm-hmm. bad thing and we need to fix it. Yeah. And so that can be really, I just can't imagine going in with that's the attitude of the medical world around surrounding this thing that your child's been diagnosed with. And then you're supposed to not only figure out what to do, but then implement it yourself. Like, it's just overwhelming.
Well, and I think one thing too, Beth, that I really liked about the documentary, and I think it kind of goes into how much access we do have today, is you had to be very curious. You had to do all of this research on your own. And then when that's all you could find, you had to turn that curiosity to Evan and really center your focus on Evan and what works for Evan and how can I, you know, you had the tags, you know, throughout your whole house, you know, and having things labeled because you realized that's what works for Evan. And I think sometimes now, because we do have a ton of access, you have a question, what do? You like hop on Facebook, you get in a Facebook group, you ask 100,000 parents what they're doing. I think that sometimes now we want somebody to tell us the answer. And because our kids are all so different, we get really discouraged if we don't just get the answer that works. And I think that we could take the lead from someone like you and look at what you had to do and maybe get a little bit more child focused and child curious for our own kids. So instead of going into these groups and maybe looking to experts, being a little more curious about our kids and really focusing on what works for them, I think sometimes too much information can be worse than little information.
Well, I do tell
the other way.
Not all of it is correct.
The first thing I say, you know, when people say, if you could, you know, go back or if you could tell someone, and I would say, become an expert on your child.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody else.
So important.
Your child.
No.
You be the expert because you're the only one that's going to really spend the time and energy to figure your child out. And when you go to a doctor, a therapist tells you something, or when they get in school and the school teacher, you're the solution person. When they call you and say, well, she had a meltdown. You got to know what to do. And if you don't know your child and you're not the expert, then you can't help develop solutions for the stages in life as they come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So true. I think one of the best pieces of advice I received early in my son's diagnosis, he's 17 now, was a very similar vein. No one loves your child and understands your child like you do.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you don't understand autism, you know your kid. You know Evan. I know Austin. You know better than anyone. And no one is going to advocate or figure out what is going to work best for them than you. All those doctors and specialists, great. I'm so glad you have that knowledge. I'm going to glean a little bit here and take a little bit there from you and you and you. And you're going to help me figure it out. But that's me, right? I'm the one who's going to really understand and come up with that plan. So I think that's great. All right. We haven't said the name of the documentary yet, and I want to make sure that we get that in there. We're making people listen a little bit first before we give them information. All right.
Teasers.
Teasers. Exactly. And the documentary is called You Have No Idea. And I want to hear. So Beth, you're just going along living your life, right? Evan's doing his thing. You're doing your thing. I'm sure you're very busy. You've got stuff happening. How did this happen? Because I'm assuming you did not direct this movie. I know you didn't direct this movie. So how did this come about?
Okay, well, it's kind of a story. First, I taught school for about 17 years. And I moved from teaching school to the nonprofit arena and began to work with nonprofits. And I began to work for the South Arkansas Arts Center, which is a nonprofit arts organization here. And so through the years, and I did that for about 10 years, and I met a lot of promising artists in theater and dance and film and voice and instrumental music. Just amazing, amazing people have come through there over the years. So that's the first part of the story. Second part of the story is when I turned 60, but I'm not even going to tell you how many, many years ago that was, my husband wanted to do kind of a special thing. And he was always kind of I mean, I'm amazed at he and his five children and how fine they are and how wonderful they are. But he always appreciated the relationship that Evan and I had. And he did think it was unusual because he says we have an unusual codependency, which we do. But he really felt like it was a life worth telling people about or looking back on. And he wanted to give my family and my friends and my community an opportunity to tell me happy birthday and the things about the story and the years that Evan and I had together in a special way. So he contacted a young man who I watched grow up at the Art Center in theater and film. And he said, Alex, he said, I would like to do a little mini happy birthday video for Beth for her 60th birthday as a surprise. And I want to get the kids on there and her friends and her family, you know, and just, you know, just in a kind of a story and an appreciation video. And he said, I thought maybe you'd be willing to do it because Alex, after he left El Dorado, he went to film school and began to make short films and documentaries. And we had kept up with each other. We knew his parents and we had kind of kept up with his career. And we had even helped him work on a feature film that he was on. And so he and his partner, Paul, another Paul, were doing short films. And so he said, would you be willing to do this video for Beth's birthday? And so they were like, yeah, of course, you know. So long story short, they interview lots of people about the situation. They talk about me. They talk about Evan. You know, they talk about Dennis. His family was on there. That's Evan's dad. And so, and they surprised me with a viewing for my 60th birthday of this film. And all my friends and all my family got to watch together at the same time. And Dennis's family were there and his kids were there. And it was just like, you know, this big birthday celebration. So after that was done, I think Alex, the director of the film, and his partner, Paul, and my Paul, went, it turned out to not be a happy birthday, Beth, we love you. It did not turn out that way. It turned out more of a discussion or a comments about the situation with Evan and Dennis and Paul and the kids and my family. It all kind of came out when those people were interviewed for my birthday video. And they already had all these interviews of people talking about what happened. And so they came to me and they said, Beth, we think this is the basis of a documentary. The only thing missing in here is you. We need to interview. I went, no.
Great.
You know, it was
Brittany's worst nightmare.
Yeah, it was beautiful and I loved it. It was just well done and I appreciate it. You know, there are a lot of things. Number one, I really wasn't the kind of person who does movies and videos. The other thing was I wasn't sure that, you know, it's a very fine line between using something for educational or emotional well-being for others, which would have been my goal, and exploiting Evan.
Yes.
And I, even though I had, and I say this in the video, when Evan was diagnosed, I did not hide him. I felt very, very strongly if he was going to have a life and if people were going to love them, they had to know him. So I did not shy away from that. I mean, we didn't stop doing one thing. We didn't stop going to church. We didn't stop going to daycare. We didn't stop, you know, I was going to figure out how he was going to proceed in a normal life and not be able to talk, kind of, or have these strange, odd behaviors. But I knew that if he was going to be able to do that, people had to know him. And so, you know, he was already out there, but there's a difference in being out there in your own hometown or being out there with your own family and being on a screen. And what would we be able to get past that to understand the value of his life and our experience. Mm-hmm. And would we be able to do that? And so I was kind of like, I'm going to have to like think about this a while. I said, it's not just me having to bear my entire life because they're not, you know, Evan's story and my story are the same story. And so to tell that story, that's my whole life, you know, and that's a lot of exposure mm-hmm. to someone's innermost thoughts and struggles. And because I said, if we do it, it's real. It has to be real, good, bad, and the ugly, mm-hmm. because that's the only way people mm-hmm. learn. That's the only way people feel close to you and bound to you and understanding of you, is if they see you at your most vulnerable point. And so to decide to do that is a big deal. So finally, absolutely. We decided that we would just shoot some things, just like they would just be here. And whatever happened,
reality TV.
We would see how Evan yeah. took to it. And then we would kind of go from there. And if it seemed like he took to it, then I would sit down for an interview. And
I think that's a good plan. Yeah.
Loved it.
did. Well, that is very, very obvious in the film.
Yes.
And that's, mm-hmm. I cannot tell you the number of times I broke out in a ridiculous grin, just listening to him and seeing him interact with the crew and with you mm-hmm. guys. It's very obvious that he was thrilled to be a part of this. So
yes. Yes. He really was. And so with that, and there, even the first couple of times they brought the camera in, you know, some not real good things happened in there. And I was kind of like, you know, watching something that you're kind of accustomed to. And when I say not very good things, I mean, Evan is Evan. And I mean, he is profound. And so there are going mm-hmm. to be things that if you're not used to seeing it every day, you know, you kind of feel uncomfortable
for people.
You know, I mean, yeah. I don't know how people feel, yeah. but I even felt a little uncomfortable watching it myself. Like, oh gosh, mm-hmm, that really right. happened. So, but I said, we have to be brave enough to show that because that's real.
And I think that's so important. It does take bravery, and you are taking a risk exposing yourself. You're taking a risk of criticism, right, from people. And not that you can't handle it. You're a very strong woman, and you're not going to let that affect you long term. But it does. It can still hurt, and you're also feeling protective of your son. You know, there's so many layers and nuances to all of this, and then there's the whole idea of, yes, we want to talk about this. We want to explain. We want people to know and really see what's going on, because that's how people are going to learn and feel more comfortable and be more inclusive. But at the same time, you want to respect his privacy and his wishes. No one wants to be filmed, you know, if they're having a rough time with something. There's so much like subtlety to all of this. And I don't know, your team, you know, Alex and everyone, I thought they did an excellent job balancing all of that.
Yes. I don't know if we had not been close to Alex. I mean, I totally trusted him. I mean, that was not a question. Mm-hmm. He is as That's fine. Great. He and Paul both are as fine two human beings as I've ever known. And their desires to tell the story and bring understanding were real. And they are real people themselves. So I didn't worry about that. And my Paul and his kids, they're great too. So it wasn't the people involved. It's just, I guess we become a little jaded over time that we'll be able to really explain to people what it is we're trying to say. And I've been in the business, you know, 30 years now. And I got to say 99% of the time, I'm treated with kindness and fairness and the beauty of humanity. I really can't, you know, I don't have horror stories of being treated terrible. But I also know that some of that is just because I didn't pay any attention. Because I'm just like,
well, and I think it's not worth it, right? And that comes with maturity and time and exposure to just let that 0.1% just go by the wayside or whatever it is. But yeah, it's interesting how you're not in charge of people's reactions. You're not supposed to accommodate people's reactions or coddle them or try to manipulate them in any way. They need to react how they're going to react. And that's not your problem, really, quite frankly. But at the same time, you know, we don't want to do anything or show anything that Evan wouldn't necessarily approve. It's so hard to know. Yeah, I commend all of you for working on this. And I love the name of the documentary. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came up with the name?
Yeah,
you have funny. No idea.
You know, Evan does have some words, okay? And he uses them appropriately. He does not have conversational language, but he has words. And he, you know, has gotten them from somewhere else, or we've taught them to him or whatever. So he has the basic vocabulary. But this story comes from in the film. Our friend Richard, who you'll meet in the film, who was Evan's godfather and Dennis, Evan's father, best friend. And he's the one that became an inclusion specialist for Evan when he was in preschool. Anyway, he kept him a lot. And Evan, of course, had echolalia very early on of things that were interesting to him, or he liked the way they rolled off his tongue, or whatever the reasons for them are. So he was keeping him one night, and he was just hanging out at Richard's apartment. And Richard said to him, "Evan, you're so weird." And Evan turns around, never has said a sentence before, and in a very scary voice goes, "You have no idea." Got it like that. And Richard just freaks out because he's like, "Oh my God, now he's, you know, he's got an exorcist or something." You know, he said a whole sentence, but it was really, really scary. So we could not figure it out for a long time, but that was his first complete sentence. And come to find out, it comes from The Lion King, which was Evan's favorite movie at the time, and still is, where Scar is talking to Simba. And he says, "Uncle Scar, you're so weird." And Scar says, "Oh, you have no idea." And so that little story has kind of, we've used it all down through the years of in many, many ways. "Oh, you have no idea." You know, what has happened and how we've meshed this together. And so when Richard told that story in his interview, it just sort of became us. And when there was the need for a title, I don't even know if we thought about it too much. We just all started laughing and said, "Oh, you have no idea." And
that's it.
It became synonymous for the life.
I love it. I think it's perfect. Yeah. Oh man. I love that. Evan is such a treasure, and you really get to see. You talk about the early days, you talk about what it was like, you know, in that transition period, you know, blending of your families, all that kind of stuff. And then you focus on at the end, you talk about Evan's transition from living at home with you to living in, I don't know what the term is you use out there. Here in California, we call them care homes or, you know, adult living or whatever. And now that's where he lives. Can you tell us a little bit about that time in your life in that period?
Having been through so many experiences, and Evan's an only child, and after his father passed away, you know, we had, like most parents do, you don't really think too much in the future. You just kind of figuring you're going to do this to the day you die, you know, and you just keep thinking about that. And you think about living forever, and you think that you're going to be able to take care of this human being, that you're, you know, going to have the energy and, you know, for like ever. And when Dennis died, I went, "Oh, it doesn't happen like that."
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, all he has in this world is me. And I began to explore, and he wasn't very old. He was out of high school, but he wasn't very old at the time. And I began to think about that and think about if in fact something happened to me, or if in fact what his adult life would look like. And what if it was just he and I? What kind of life was that? And how would he become exposed to people his age and people going through things that he was going through, because his mother was aging by the day and it was all he had. And I, you know, and he still takes a little assistance with, you know, some physical things. And I felt myself getting, even then, tired and older and more worried. And so I began to give myself permission to think about that, to think about what his life would be like with me, without me, and what was good for him. And when you give yourself permission to do that, all the options are open. And that means living with you, not living with you, not having a sibling that would kind of pick up, and would you want the sibling to, even if right. that were the case, because that mm-hmm. might not, I'm not, no judgment calls, but you have to think about all those things. Is that what you want the sibling to do? Is that the kind of life you want them to have? Or the niece or the nephew, or who's going to worry about the money? Who's going to? And I be kind of, I suspect, because we had had this death in our family, I was probably thinking about it more than maybe most people would at that time. And so I gave myself permission to think about options. And in the meantime, as I was still thinking about all of this, Paul did come into my life, and it maybe it paused me for a minute, but not very long, because I knew intrinsically that not having me could not be replaced by someone else. Mm-hmm. And yes, I could legally mm-hmm. find someone who would be responsible for him financially or make decisions for him or whatever. That didn't help Evan, because his emotional state depended on me. And mm-hmm. so how did I find a place for him in a way in which he could trust? And so we just began to look at places, care places, group homes, day programs. We didn't go and say, oh gosh, we got to do this today, you know, but we did begin.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go, no, this doesn't feel, I kept telling myself, you're going to feel it. You're going to know it's going to be okay. And so I would walk into, you know, and Paul was in St. Louis, and gosh, you know, I thought, oh, we'll find the handicapped country club. We'll find this perfect place, you know, that he's just going to walk into and go, don't need you anymore, Mom. Well, that was not going to happen, right? So, but we mm-hmm. looked in several states. We, and finally, and if you watch the documentary, this kind of all comes out. We had to, Evan was just not happy in St. Louis, even though he had a fine life. And really, Paul's children are phenomenal. His family, my family, Dennis's family, we're all on a team. So that wasn't an issue. But mm-hmm. because we had exposed him to so much community and family, bingo, I realized, well, you can't give him all of those things and then take them away. Mm-hmm. And so he and I came back to Arkansas, and I continued to, then it was really just him and I. I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, he's 20 years old or 21, whatever. And his life is his mom. What kind of life is that? Just because I'm trying to protect him and I don't want to feel guilty about putting him out there, or, you know, it's still not a life. And if something happened to me tomorrow, he has nothing. And I walked into my church one Sunday, and there was an older gentleman who lived in a town about 40 miles from us, who had had a handicapped daughter and had been very involved in that community. That's College Town, about 40 miles from us. And I just asked him one day, I said, you know, I've got Evan. He said, come to Magnolia Tuesday morning at 11 o'clock. He said, I think I've got a solution for you. And I said, okay. So I get in my car and I drive to this place I did not know existed. And it was a day program and a group home for men. Little southern town, another little southern town, 40 miles from us, where people talk the same. And, you know, Evan got very undone, I think, because the vernacular of people in the Midwest was just not something he understood. You know, he needed big southern women.
And, oh my god,
long
I love
story
it.
Short, I was okay. Now I knew
felt
that
good.
And one reason I was okay was because I knew I could get to him. That was important to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also important to me to share this transition with him. We would do it together. It wouldn't be like drop you off, say goodbye, have a nice life, Evan. No, I would do it with him step by step. And we started by driving over there and looking. Then we went in the next trip. It must have taken us 6 months for him to actually spend the night. He would go to the day program for 30 minutes. I would ride around town, pick him up. So he would know I was coming back, you know, and then I'd take him in the morning. I'd pack his lunch so that he wouldn't be all food paranoid. Because he does have bad food issues. And, you know, so he and I did it every single step. Then I'd let him go all day and I'd pick him up. Then I'd let him go and ride the transport to the group home. And I'd pick him. I'd be there when he got off the bus. Then the next time I'd wait 10 minutes after he got off the bus and go. Then maybe he'd stay an hour. I mean, this went on and on and on. And I stood with him every step of the way. Like, I'm dropping you off. I'm picking you up. You and Mom are doing this together. You're not alone. And after a while, the first night he spent the night, you know, of course, I'm at my house. You know, like, oh my God, what's
I'm
he
sure that wasn't
what's
a great night for you.
You know, I want a camera in his room so that I can see every move he makes. I want to see everything that everyone says to him. I want to know what he ate. I want to, if he ate at all, you know, I mean, all of this stuff. And I mean, he's, you know, he's in his 20s and I'm still worried about, like, did he get anything to eat? You know?
Yeah.
It's real. Yeah. The fears are real. And they're okay. But you know what? We did it. We allowed ourselves to think about it. We gave ourselves the time to find it. And then we gave ourselves the time to transition to it for us both. I'm sure I was more, when it came right down to it, I was more scared than he was. I feel sure I was. And now, you know, they go to dances, they go on vacation, you know, and I can FaceTime him and, you know, he's there now. I mean, sometimes he goes on Monday and stays till Friday. And I'm telling you, now that I'm so much older, I am so grateful that I'm not doing it now at 65, that I did it at 55, started thinking about it, or even 50, and beginning to think, what am I going to do and how am I going to do it? Because it would, the older you get, things are harder and harder and harder for you. You know, your energy level, mm-hmm. your physical abilities. Think about that. Think about how you take care of your child now and how you emotionally and physically take care of him. And think about still doing it at 65. That's a big deal. Like, it's mm-hmm. harder for me to get down there every morning and put those shoes and socks on. It wasn't at 35 when I started doing it, but 65 is a whole new ballgame. And so mm-hmm. I am grateful. I feel blessed to have even thought about this when I did. And because I think there's a lot of guilt about what we're going to do. I'm glad I gave myself permission to think about it. I am. Because it's not
so important. Yeah, it's so important because it can be very paralyzing. I think people are terrified to even allow themselves to think about it. So I like how you talked about giving yourself permission. Even if it's just thinking about it, you're not even doing anything yet. Just think about it, okay? And let yourself mull over those thoughts and those ideas and imagine what it could look like, right? That's the first step. And once you can stomach that or it doesn't drive you into a panic, then maybe you start going and looking at some things. Just looking. We're not committing to anything, right? And it's just baby steps. And it is so important for you to do those things for Evan. It's going to be very important for me to do that with my child, my children. I have two. But it's just as important for you as the caregiver to do those things too, because it's going to be very, very difficult, especially us three moms who are very much control people. We like to be in control and in charge. We all have that energy on this call right now, mm-hmm. right? And it's something that we're going to have to learn how to accommodate and let go as well. Mm-hmm. It's going to take time and effort, and it's not going to be perfect. I'm sure all of those visits and all of those times that you took, Evan, not all of them went well, I'm sure, right? But you kept trying and finding that thing. And I just love how you showed up to church and this, you were already looking, you were already trying. I'm sure you were praying about it. You were working, you were, you know, looking at everything you had and listening to yourself. But then you're at church and this person shows up and he's like, this is it. This is the answer. I love that. Mm-hmm. Tosh is going to be all about that.
It's a God thing.
Yeah, it's right. My whole life is a God thing, you know?
It's a God thing. Yeah.
It's amazing.
I think too, like, you know, we were lucky enough to have a Zoom with you before this call. And there were things that you said. One is, you know, giving yourself permission. And sometimes I think we need permission from someone else. And so I think you talking about that today, I think is going to help a lot of listeners. You also, it just seemed so simple because on the call, you were like, we can go and we can look at these places. Like, I can just look. I don't have to put him in any of these. And it was just kind of like it clicked for me. Like, you're right. I absolutely can just go and look and have literally no commitment whatsoever. Like, it doesn't have to be a decision that was made. And then you would also said, and this kind of, I think, goes into the control freakishness of, you know, all of us here. But if something happens to me, somebody else is going to make this decision and they're not going to do it the way that I would do it. He would end up in this group home right away, possibly with no transition period, without you there to help him along, to show him that he's going to be okay, that this is something that he can do on his own without you there. And I can imagine that that brings you a lot of peace to know that if something does happen to you now, like, you did that with him. You guys did this together and it was done your way.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it's kind of selfish in a way. I wanted to feel better about it. Mm-hmm. I wanted to have, mm-hmm. as we all do, I wanted the plan And I wanted the plan to be my plan, not somebody else's, not mm-hmm. the state's, not, you know, my sister's mm-hmm. or I wanted it to be mine. And I wanted to watch him do it with him. And so you're right. If I, something happens to me tomorrow, I feel okay. I mean, I know it won't, not, listen, when I lost my father, it was terrible. And I didn't have the codependency with him that I mm-hmm. Evan has with me. So yes, I know nothing's going to replace that. It's, you know, yeah. he's going to have a transition. So I get that. Mm-hmm. But at least I know he's not going to feel unfamiliar, uncared for, unloved. It's nothing new to him. And he will progress through that too. And it makes me be able to sleep at night that mm-hmm. that has been accomplished. And mm-hmm. so I feel better having done it than worrying.
And that, yeah, you could say that that's selfish, but really, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You deserve mm-hmm. to have peace of mind too, just as much as Evan does. We all do, right? It's important. And you guys, I think in a way you've mentioned before that I think your relationship with Evan is better in some ways because he has his life and you have yours. That's important. You know, sometimes, you know, spending too much time with people makes it harder to be with them or to love them. Sometimes some space is good, you know, for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we get on much better and he's happy to see me and I'm happy to see him. And, you know, like if a regular schedule and he's with me, you know, he goes maybe during the week and then he's with me on the weekend. When I pick him up, we're happy, you know, and it's not, yeah. and we don't feel, I don't know how you guys feel, but sometimes as much as you love, and this would be a typical child at 20 or 15.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, like you're not always best friends and it's not always like just because you love each other and are codependent. It's just not. And so I do like it better that he gets to go do whatever it is he does over there. And I get to work in my yard and I get to take better care of myself. And I get to do some life experiences that makes me better when I have him. And I'm not just like, oh my God, another day of doing everything for Evan, shower time, doing the schedule. You know, blah, 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 that I've been doing for 30 years. There is something very satisfying about knowing that he can take those skills into another environment. I can kind of facilitate and he can survive because of the things that we've done. And that's inspiring and that makes me feel better. And if I get to pull my weeds a little bit, before he comes home, I'm gonna be better at that schedule and I'm gonna be, you know, more apt to do something that's good for him or fun for him because I haven't been doing it the last 5 days.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, I think that's so important.
Win-win for he and I both.
I agree. Space is good and time is good and that respite for yourself and for Evan to grow and learn and to do your own thing. We're going to be much happier when we're together. I think that's so important. Documentary, You Have No Idea is the name of it. You can Google that. Where can you watch it right now?
Do you can watch it on Amazon places? Prime and you can watch it on Apple TV.
Okay. And I believe there's a small fee to rent or buy it. But it's totally worth it. We, have all watched it, all of us girls on Moms Talk Autism, and we were just gushing about it. It's a little bit of everything. You get this very interesting story about, you know, back, makes it sound so old. We lived in the 90s too, right? Back in the 90s, back in the day, right? But beginning that diagnosis story, working through all of that, seeing Evan now, talking about that in transition. It was filmed, some of it was filmed during, you know, the pandemic, which is very kind of interesting how you guys manage some of that, those challenges, his other diagnoses that he has, not just autism, but some of his other medical needs. And then the ending about this transition time and this period of him becoming more independent and you having that chance to learn and grow and be on your own as well. It's just, it's so inspiring, but it's not sugarcoated. And what I think I love most about it is I walked away feeling hope, but I also had a million other questions and I felt motivated and interested to find out more things maybe about my own children or programs available in my area. There was this drive to like learn more. And I think that's the best part about the documentary is it's the inspiration that can come from it. So we really encourage everybody to go watch it and maybe find that inspiration for yourself, for your own family, and to be curious and give yourself permission to imagine things, right? To really look and think about it. If there's anything else that you would like to say, Beth, to our audience, to other parents out there who are maybe at different stages or maybe in the same stage you are, what else would you like to say?
I don't know.
I know we didn't prep you for this.
Yeah, you did. I think that it's for all of us, and I kind of wish someone had maybe said this to me. I think it is helpful, excuse me, to not get so overwhelmed by today that we limit our possibilities and we don't imagine a future. And I say that with living skills or living situations or things for yourself. There is going to be a future. It's going to be a good one. And you're going to love that you took this journey with this kid for sure. There's no doubt about that. It's going to change you. It's going to make you better. It's going to make you see other people totally differently in a good way. You're going to hone your strengths. But there is a future. And so that every decision that you make, not everyone, a lot of decisions you make, should be based on the fact that there's a future for you and for them. And it's going to be really great. So don't get so hung up in today that you forget to think about a whole big life of life experiences and changes and good things and bad things. Don't just focus on, oh my gosh, this is not good or this is different or what am I going to do? All that's necessary. But you're going to have a big old life with this kid. And it's not going to be like it is right now. So imagine it. Imagine what it's going to be like. This is going to be pretty cool.
That permission again.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. I couldn't say it better. Thank you so much for being on with us today, Beth. Beth James Burns, the documentary is You Have No Idea. Go ahead and look that up. We'll have a link for it in the show notes, of course. You can reach out to us if you have more questions for Beth, and we can maybe get those to her. But this is something not only for you to watch for yourself, but I think it's really, really important for maybe those people who are your family or your friends or who interact with your own children to see it as well. There's a lot of other caregivers and other people in Evan's life who are featured in the documentary. And that village comes through, that feeling of community comes through really, really strongly in the film. So it's so, so important. It's something we talk about in every episode of this show. So we really appreciate it. Thank you so much for being here, Beth.
Thank y'all.
We appreciate you. You were a joy.
You can contact us at hello@momstalkautism or go to our website at momstalkautism.com. And we will see you next week. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.